This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The idea is that you and I get briefed together on the important questions of the day by people who know what they're talking about. And if it works for you, or even if it doesn't, please let us know what you think by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. Thanks this week to AWL1990 for doing just that. And this week we're asking what difference the election of Imran Khan to the leadership of Pakistan will make to his country and to the world. And if you enjoy this podcast, you might want to listen back to other editions of The Briefing Room. For example, the one we did earlier this year about China's ambitious infrastructure project, Belt and Road, which has huge implications for Pakistan.
I today want all of Pakistan to unite. I want to make clear that any of our opponents, people who voted against us, I think the kind of personal attacks that I've faced, no one has ever faced them before. I have forgotten all of this and put all of this behind me. This is not about me, this is about my country.
Remember Imran Khan, the international cricketer turned playboy? It looks like he's won this week's election and is just about to turn leader of Pakistan. And Pakistan matters. 200 million people live there. The country is historically linked with Britain. Many British citizens have current ties to Pakistan. It has nuclear weapons and is geographically and strategically a hugely important place. So this week, step into the briefing room to find out what difference Imran Khan will make to his country and the world. First, I asked the Pakistani historian Ayesha Jalal, Professor of History at Tufts University in the United States, to join us from Lahore, where she voted in the election, and to give us a historical survey of Pakistani politics.
1947, the creation of Pakistan.
Citizens of Pakistan, it is with feelings of greatest happiness and emotion that I send you my greetings. August the 15th.
Well, the partition of India left Pakistan with a very uneven legacy insofar as it acquired about 33% of the military personnel of undivided India and a mere 17.5% of the financial assets. So Pakistan started its career with a problematic defense burden. Pakistan was a country split in two with 1,000 miles of Indian territory. And it would be fair to say that by the early 1950s, the military was pretty much in a very commanding position within the political structure. And then, of course, the first coup d'etat occurred in 1958. And since then, Pakistan has struggled, really, over the years to restore some semblance of a democratic government.
1971, East Pakistan becomes Bangladesh.
Pakistan launched a full-scale war against us.
India, a predatory aggressor, a country that has never reconciled herself to Pakistan, has committed naked aggression for the third time on the soil of...
When the first elections to be held on universal adult franchise were held, the Eastern Wing had a majority and was won pretty much completely by the Awami League of Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, whereas in West Pakistan, it was the Pakistan People's Party led by Zulfikar Ali Bhutto. But the failure to arrive at power-sharing arrangements resulted in military intervention, And so what was a political problem was seen primarily as a national security issue by the military, and the crackdown occurred. And then, of course, there was Indian intervention, which led to the breakup of Pakistan in December of 1971.
1977, Pakistan under General Zia.
The armed forces of Pakistan have taken over the administration of the country this morning. This has been announced by a military spokesman in Rawalpindi.
Under Ziaul Haq, with Pakistan becoming a frontline state in the war against the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, the Pakistan military did acquire a good deal more importance within the overall structure. The intelligence agency, the ISI, particularly grew massively during this period. A lot of money came in during this period. I mean, Pakistan's military was, of course, pursuing the war against the Soviets in Afghanistan, and that sort of led to nurturing a particular kind of Islam that many regard as very noxious in the sense of being sectarian, of being militant. And so Pakistan shifted from being a pretty much secular country, which of course paid lip service to religiosity, but never this degree of religiosity that set in motion in the aftermath of Zia's Islamization policies.
1988, the return of democracy.
May I put it to you, ladies and gentlemen, it is not a question of whether a man or a woman should be head of state or head of government. It is simply a question of how this country should be run.
The 1990s in Pakistan are generally remembered as a lost era of democracy. It saw a great deal of political instability, and it brought in the first instance, the Pakistan People's Party, led by Benazir Bhutto, followed by, in 1990, the Pakistan Muslim League, led by Mian Nawaz Sharif. And then again in 93, another government by Benazir, and then again another government in 96 by Nawaz Sharif, leading up to Musharraf's coup in October of 1999.
My dear countrymen, I wish to inform you that the armed forces have moved in as a last resort to prevent any further destabilization.
Musharraf's coup of October 1999 was partly prompted by the then Prime Minister Mian Nawaz Sharif's decision to appoint a new army chief without informing the one who was serving. So this, of course, led to a direct contest between the military high command and the prime minister, which eventually was settled in the interests of the military high command. A coup occurred. Musharraf's attempts to become a popular leader himself backfired, and he was not able to retain his army uniform and retain the presidency eventually, and had to step down after elections were held in 2008.
2008, democracy once more.
I think there's always been a tussle between the elected and non-elected institutions, between elements in civil society and those that have been responsible for the authoritarianism in Pakistan's state structure. That battle has gone on. What has changed in more recent times is that it's become clear that even military rulers, even military regimes need legitimacy. And that realization on the part of the military has meant that they have also needed civilian faces at the appropriate moment in order to persist in power. Since the 2008 elections, Pakistan has not only completed its first ever transition from one civilian government to another in 2013, but the second one as well has occurred in, this year, which is, the elections are taking place. So that's a great advance.
Ayesha Jalal, that's the deep background. But now I want to know what was at stake in the election campaign and what the progress of that campaign told us about the state of Pakistan in 2018. Joining me in the briefing room from Karachi is Shahzeb Jilani, a senior executive editor of a private television station there called Dunya. Shahzeb Jilani, Imran Khan's party has claimed victory. I take it that means he's going to be prime minister.
Yes, he's been talking about being a captain of the team, and he was certainly one of the most successful cricket captains of Pakistan. He is the brand people have voted for. So, yes, definitely.
Now, in Pakistan, does the party matter more than the individual, or is the individual the kernel of that the party then surrounds?
The party matters a great deal, but the head of the party is more important. So people have connected with Imran Khan and what he stands for.
Now, what does the name of his party even mean?
In English, it would mean a movement for justice. Essentially, when he started out in politics, he emphasized that in a country where people don't get justice, that's where all the problems begin. So he had made this as sort of the main pitch around which he started his politics some 22 years ago.
So when he talks about justice, what kind of justice is he talking about? Economic justice? Is he a left-winger, a socialist? Or does he mean justice against people who misuse the system?
That's a good question. Imran Khan has said different things at different times. But essentially, what he talked about is kind of a welfare state. And he started using Islamic history. He talked about how in the times of Prophet Muhammad, it was an egalitarian and welfare society. Then he quickly adds and mentions Sweden and some of the Scandinavian countries as the perfect example of that Islamic role model. And his argument has been that we strayed away and we have created economic inequality. Our police is oppressive. Our ordinary people do not get justice. When they go to public offices, government buildings, they are asked for bribes. And then slowly, gradually, the whole argument is then centered around corruption. So in Imran Khan's worldview, corruption is the core of Pakistan's problem, because there are all these traditional parties, rich politicians, aristocrats who rob public money and stash it away abroad in properties in London and other Western countries. And so his quick fix was, if we can take care of these corrupt politicians, Pakistan has much to offer. It can be a respectable country again, and we can solve our poverty and other problems.
But does he have an economic program to solve these problems over and above dealing with corruption? I mean, it does seem to me, as somebody who's observed these things for some time, that when you say you're going to deal with corruption, it kind of lets you off the hook of saying what else you're going to do.
Yes, and I think that's true for Imran Khan. He doesn't go into details and specifics, so he's really kind of championed slogans which he thinks will resonate with people. And his anti-corruption campaign really resonated with young Pakistanis, with women, with middle-class urban people who usually are not part of political process. They don't bother with vote. They've actually tended to support military dictators because they think dictators bring stability to the country and politicians only cause chaos and instability. So Imran Khan essentially offered himself as an antithesis of traditional politics in Pakistan.
Who's been the main opponent of Imran Khan's party?
It's Nawaz Sharif, a three-time prime minister who was convicted of corruption for living beyond his means by the Pakistani Supreme Court, and he's currently in jail. So what's different this time is Imran Khan said, look, I've been playing this populist politics, but I've not been getting enough support. So this time he said, I'm going to accept some of these corrupt politicians who support Nawaz Sharif, and there's plenty of evidence to suggest that the army was helping him. So just about, you know, a few months before this election was held, many of Nawaz Sharif's parliamentarians ditched him. And they started saying that we are really impressed with Imran Khan. He's the man. He's our savior. So we are joining his party.
And these people took votes with them, did they?
Yes. In Pakistani sort of political jargon, they are called electables. So these are people who are known for switching sides. So they are known for going with the popular wave because their own constituencies are in their grip. So wherever these guys go, the vote swings with them. And they are hot favorites of the army because army has invariably used them to prop up, you know, artificial leadership. So this time Imran Khan was criticized for this because some of his core supporters who've been with him for two decades said, but these are exactly the same people you've been campaigning against. And he tried to rationalize by saying that, look, I've lost so many elections. I'm not getting anywhere. So sometimes ends justify the means. I'm going to take them on board, but I'm still the captain, and I'm going to make sure that we do things right.
Now, you say that the army helped swing these electables behind Imran Khan. I mean, how did they actually do that, and what evidence do we have that they did that?
So they're a combination of sort of carrot and stick. I mean, remember, Pakistan is a country where the army wields enormous influence over every aspect of public life. So in this particular case, what they traditionally do and have done, and there's evidence, some, you know, reports have come out, is that they would approach these politicians and say, that, you know, there are a number of corruption cases against you. Do you want us to pursue them? Or would you rather switch sides and secure your constituency and maybe even become a cabinet member? And many of these people are easily persuaded.
So why would the army want to support Imran Khan if he's the great reformer? Isn't there a danger to them that he'll reform them?
In order to understand why they would be supporting Imran Khan, I think it's important to understand why they hated Nawaz Sharif. Nawaz Sharif was brought into politics, again, by a military dictator in the 1980s. But over the years, he had a sort of change of heart, and he started resisting some of the army chiefs. In this tenure, in the last 4 years, Nawaz Sharif wanted to improve relations with India and Afghanistan because his fundamental thesis was, unless we have peace at home and with our neighbors, we cannot prosper. The army has traditionally treated foreign policy as its domain, and it doesn't like civilians taking initiatives with India and Afghanistan. So they started to see him as a threat.
Shazem Jilani. Exit Nawaz, enter Imran then. And the one point of continuity is the role of the army. But will the election make a difference to the solving of Pakistan's many problems? I'm joined now from Rome by Hussein Haqqani. He's been associated with the main actors in Pakistani politics over the course of his long career and was for 3 years Pakistan's ambassador to the United States. Hussein Haqqani, do you think it actually mattered who won this election?
I personally don't. I think Pakistan's problems are deeper. I know that a lot of Pakistanis are convinced that corruption is the only problem, which is why they tend to support Imran Khan, because they see him as somebody who is untainted by corruption. He's never been in government. That said, Pakistan's real problems are that its military is overbearing. It does not allow Pakistan to have some kind of settlement with India. It has bad relations with three of its four neighbors, with Iran, with Afghanistan, and with India. It has a tense relationship with the United States. It has a lot of jihadi terrorist groups that it does not want to eliminate. The military doesn't. And it has an economic crisis looming. Mr. Imran Khan hasn't offered any solutions for any of that. So yes, there will be celebration by those who supported one party or another, depending on what the turnout is. But Pakistan's deeper problems need deeper solutions.
Why, in your view, is there such a reluctance to address those deeper problems?
The Pakistani military has become an ideological organization rather than a team of professional soldiers. It interferes with everything. It has run Pakistan directly for more than half of its life. Judges receive calls from generals to decide cases one way or another. Media is instructed by the military as how to cover something. And they are convinced that India is Pakistan's eternal enemy. Some would argue that it's a cynical ploy because Pakistan needs a big threat to justify a big army. But I personally think that many of them, actually, because of the way they are trained and educated, really believe it. Now, when you start believing in an eternal threat to the country, and you are a soldier whose primary job is to try and figure out how to eliminate the enemy rather than to negotiate with political opponents, then you create circumstances in which you take very hard-line stances. So just to give you an example, Pakistan exports only $22 billion worth of goods and services. That's very small for the size of the country it is, 200 million people. Half of its population is under the age of 21. Yet one-third of children between the age of 5 and 15 don't go to school. Pakistan has much lower literacy than India or Bangladesh. And its quality of education is deemed significantly poor. Now, there is an elite, of which I would consider myself a part, that speaks very good English, is seen internationally, like Imran Khan, plays cricket. But the fact of the matter is, that the masses are not really equipped to generate the kind of wealth that a modern country needs. Instead, Pakistan has tended to depend on the United States and the West for aid for many, many years, citing its strategic location, which has led to the current situation where the West says, we've given you so much aid, eliminate terrorism, which Pakistan tends to support. And now Pakistan's dependence is rising on China.
In other words, are you suggesting that people fall back on much easier solutions and slogans rather than the really difficult problems of tackling the innate structural problems that Pakistan has?
Absolutely. In fact, there is very little discussion of structural problems. It seems that some people are reconciled to these structural problems as part of what it means to be a Pakistani. And they always blame people like myself, who are Pakistanis, but who say we have a problem. And to the rest of the world, which is critical of Pakistan, they say to them, you don't understand Pakistan.
Was there anything about this particular campaign that stood out for you?
Yes. The most glaring thing was that the mainstream political parties like Mr. Nawaz Sharif's Pakistan Muslim League, known as PMLN, they were under a lot of constraints. They were being blocked out of the media. In case of Mr. Sharif, he was being sent to prison because he was being convicted. Several of his party men were disqualified by the Supreme Court arbitrarily. But on the other hand, several Islamist extremists who are on the UN's list of designated terrorists were allowed to run openly. None of them have won their seat so far in the results that have come out. But the fact that they were allowed to campaign like normal politicians instead of being treated as terrorists was definitely something that strikes me as unusual.
Unusual bad or unusual good?
Unusual bad, because after all, if you mainstream terrorists, you invite the appellation of being a state sponsor of terrorism much quicker than Pakistan has done in the past.
Now, let us suppose that Imran Khan becomes persuaded in some way of the virtue of the arguments that you're making and of the needs that Pakistan has for change. If he did, what changes would he concretely make?
But he would have to make four major changes. Number one, Pakistan spends more than it produces. It's an import-dependent economy. It doesn't export as much as it imports. It has too large a military, and it has too much conflict around it. So the four things that he would have to do immediately is seriously figure out how to deal with terrorism, try to invest more in building human capital so that Pakistan can increase its national wealth. The third thing he would do is to change Pakistan's foreign policy completely from this dependence on one major power based on strategic concerns. Previously, it was America. Now it's China. Instead, Pakistan needs to have normal relations with its immediate neighbors, India, Iran, Afghanistan, and of course with China too. And the fourth thing he needs to do is basically figure out a way of ensuring that all Pakistani institutions work according to the constitution and under rule of law, and that the military stops being a supra institution.
Now, I presume that the military, if they're as powerful as you say they are, would not actually tolerate him doing the final thing.
Absolutely. And so basically that's where Pakistan's dilemma lies. Hence my relative cynicism. I've been accused of cynicism, and I don't mind it sometimes, because we must remember, just as Imran Khan was supported by the military in this election, Nawaz Sharif was supported similarly in the 1990 election, which was equally controversial. And Mr. Sharif eventually, 30 years later, had to be disqualified under the military's direction by the Supreme Court of Pakistan and is currently in prison because he figured out over the last three decades that changes needed to be introduced. So yes, Mr. Khan does run that risk, but I would suggest that he start with the first three and maybe come to the fourth later. I doubt that he will be able to do the first three either.
Hussein Haqqani. And finally, the world. What does the Khan victory mean for Pakistan's neighbours and allies? Professor Catherine Adeney is director of the Asia Research Institute at the University of Nottingham, from where she joins me. Catherine Adeney, how significant is a Pakistani general election for international relations?
That's a really interesting question, because
traditionally, the foreign policy of Pakistan has not resided in the hands of the elected representatives at all. So since Pakistan's independence from Britain, the army has really held the strings of power in relation to foreign policy and external relations more generally. I mean, one of the reasons that the army targeted Nawaz Sharif and one of the reasons that there were so many judicial cases against him, ultimately leading to his imprisonment, was the fact that he had explicitly challenged the army. So given that, and given that Khan is widely seen to be supported by the military in his election campaign, we would expect that Khan would be doing the army's bidding on foreign policy.
Now, what does that actually mean in relationship to relations with India?
So Imran Khan has been very, very strident against India and has accused Nawaz Sharif of cozying up to the India Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Now, we know that Nawaz Sharif was in favour of better relations with India, so we could expect to see a hardening of position. Having said that, though, relations have not been particularly friendly over the last few years anyway, and that's as much to do with the attitude of Narendra Modi as it is to do with the Pakistani army.
Does this mean that actually we could see things get worse?
It is potentially you could see things get worse. So one of the areas of concern is the China-Pakistan economic corridor comes through a part of Pakistan that is contested territory by India. Now, India has stridently opposed that and sees it as an attack on, you know, its sovereignty and its territorial borders. It's possible that we might see more of a move towards integrating that part of the contested territory into Pakistan proper in order to secure Chinese development.
Now, what about relations with the Americans?
That's going to be an extremely interesting area to watch, not least because Imran Khan has been extremely anti-America in the past. So he opposed US drone strikes. Back in January this year, he accused Donald Trump of being ignorant and ungrateful and humiliating the country. So how those two are going to work together is going to be interesting to watch. It's very much going to be, I think, business as usual behind the scenes. We've seen moves towards the Pakistan working much closer with America and Afghanistan, not least over the killing of Maulana Fazullah in June this year, the leader of the Pakistan Taliban. So we would expect to see that relations would kind of continue on a smooth and steady course, if not particularly friendly.
So in other words, Imran Khan, who's been opposed to things like the killing of this Pakistani Taliban leader, will actually be brought round to believing that such things are actually all right now he's prime minister.
I suspect that power will moderate him somewhat. As said, his freedom of manoeuvre in this area is very much reduced. And we're expecting to see Pakistan to go to the IMF in the next few months as well because of its economic situation. So again, the incentives to keep the Americans happy are going to be quite high.
Now, finally, what about Afghanistan? It's always been said that the problem in Afghanistan, one of the big problems in Afghanistan, has been Pakistani interference largely on the side of the Afghan Taliban. There's been something of a push for peace, for a peace process going on in Afghanistan itself. Do you think Imran Khan's election impacts upon that in any way?
As said, I think it's going to be the army that makes the final call on this. The problem for Pakistan is that it's extremely worried about being encircled by India and an India-backed Afghanistan. And I would suspect that it would be keeping some reserves, shall we say, in terms of it doesn't want to cut its links with the Afghan Taliban in its entirety. Although I think it will do quite a lot publicly. But maybe there'll be quite a lot hidden behind the scenes as well.
Catherine Aidney. Oh, what have I learned? Plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose, as they say in Karachi. Or to put it another way, in Pakistan, whoever you vote for, the army gets in. My thanks to Ayesha Jalal, Shahzeb Jilani, Hussein Haqqani and Catherine Aidney. We'll be back next week. Until then, goodbye. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by Tim Mansell, Serena Tarling and Olivia Beasley. And if you enjoyed listening to this, you may also enjoy the BBC podcast series on the murder of Benazir Bhutto. It's called The Assassination. Please let us know what you think about this programme or the entire series, and you can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. We really do enjoy hearing from you.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.